Recorded live.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry I'm dragging today. Just got in from EMS weekend. All of you who, if anybody's on the call from the weekend, Steph and I and Leslie and Chris and Angela and everybody, want to thank you for joining us. It was just an amazing blessing to have you there be with us. So, we have got some questions. Let's see here. There we go. Question number one. My husband took a couple of sexual addiction assessments, one from Mark Laser's site, I think it's called the SATA or something like that. All assessments say he has a sexual addiction. He found a sexual addiction therapist locally through Mark's website. I believe she confirmed it's an addiction too. I want to be 100% sure. How can we know for sure that he has a sexual addiction? Should he talk to you, Mark Laser? Have you ever had someone lie to make it look like they have a sex addiction to cover up just a regular affair? My husband denied at first his behavior could be an addiction, but the more we read about it, after he took Mark's assessment, he accepted it. Now, I'm the one wondering if he made it up. Here is his behavior. 10 years with hours of compulsive masturbation, with 4 and 3 years of compulsive masturbation, looking at things more than one cybersex partner while at the same time watching porn, 3 years with a handful of real-life masturbation in front of one of the cybersex partners. Sometimes they would have sex instead of just him masturbating in front of her. All I can say is that if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, most likely it's a duck. And that sure looks like a duck to me. I mean, that everything you're describing in terms of the compulsivity and the characteristics of sexual addiction, that certainly would apply. It's something that's gotten worse over time. I would see no reason, first off, why anybody would want to make up having a sexual addiction. The reality is it would be easier for someone to deal with recovering from a one-night stand or an affair than it would from, because the sexual addiction means that you've got to live with that for the rest of your life. So, I mean, just in terms of assuring you, I don't see why someone would fake worse than it really is. And the second thing is, I would much rather have somebody assume they have a sexual addiction and treat it as such than just assume they had a one-night stand that needs to be treated. I mean, one of the things I do is, I told somebody this weekend at EMS, I would rather you assume that you've got this issue so that you begin to live according to the fact that this is the worst case scenario. You've got it. Now, let's spend the rest of our life accepting you're not normal and accept what you need to do in order to keep your mate safe as you walk through this. So hopefully, if he's seeing the thing that is even more serious and kind of a lifelong piece, I'd rather have somebody dealing with the lifelong piece, because I know they're more likely to stay safe than the person who believes they just had one affair or even an ongoing affair and that they won't ever do it again. Because the person with the addiction, if they're seeing that counselor and all, they're going to learn a whole new lifestyle that allows them to stay safe. So for your sake, I actually hope it's an addiction. Well, I hope he accepts it's an addiction, because he's going to be far more motivated to take responsibility for it himself and to do what's necessary. And everything you're saying there would indicate to me that it's an addiction. Okay. My husband said to his therapist and to me after his session that he told her he wants to come clean on everything. I discovered the affair last June, and he claimed it was only an emotional thing and not sexual or physical. He said that he ended it before I found out. I had noticed porn on our computer occasionally in the past 3 years. Then in November, he admitted to a 3-year addiction to meds from surgery 4 years ago. In January, I found out found more porn on the computer, claimed that he had no idea how it got there. He didn't do it. We have a 5- and a 2-year-old. And a couple of weeks later, found a very old email on our computer from 2 years ago asking a woman on Craigslist for sex. I want to know everything, or I'm afraid we will not be able to reconcile our marriage from my side. He said that he wants to tell me everything a week ago and has not brought it up since. Is it okay for me to ask him about this or wait for him to come to me about telling me everything? I'm still not sure if it's going to be the truth or a half-truth, but I do want to know. I have that feeling that if he is so hesitant to tell me that it's not good things he's going to be telling me. Well, I would doubt that it's good things if he's been unfaithful. But I need to know, and the longer he goes on this, this goes on, the less sympathetic I am going to be toward his admission. What should I do? Great question. And, you know, a lot of times for people as they grow and heal, sometimes the release or when people are able to come clean, and I'm not, obviously I haven't talked to you guys, I don't know, but it's learning and being able to share more oftentimes is a sign, a good sign, not a bad sign, but it's a sign that they're actually beginning to make progress, so to speak, just because they're kind of growing. I don't know if this guy's moving forward, if he's not moving forward. If he's hiding information, though, I'm kind of concerned about that. So I would bring it, I would actually bring it up and say, you know, are you ready to let me know the story? Are you, you know, what's the plan? I'd kind of like to know maybe when we're going to be able to talk about this. Do you want to talk about it from the session or the therapist? And in that sense, maybe that would help. Another thing that might be useful, I don't know if you've done anything like 911 marriage, but this weekend at EMS, and the same thing happens frequently on 911, there were six couples that just worked as hard as they could. I mean, at just trying to be brutally honest. And they were sharing the story of what being honest was like. I mean, they were really doing a nice job of rationally kind of standing at the 30,000 feet and looking at what this behavior was and not having an emotional conversation, but rationally looking at it. And there was one person that had never really shared any of the information. Well, had shared just a little bit, kind of the minimum requirement, but had never gone more into it. And what was amazing was on the second day, after listening and watching all the other participants just bare their souls, she was really, one, kind of convicted, but two, she began to see how it was possible, as did her husband, and how in the world she could share the rest of the information with him. So Saturday night, and because it's not like it takes a long time or anything, Saturday night she told him the whole story. And one of the things that was useful for her is at least she and I were able to meet beforehand, and I worked with her basically on how to tell the timeline, because, again, I believe that you do need to know the story, but you may not, but you don't necessarily need to know a whole lot of typically detail. I find that not to be very useful, simply because it's one level of detail it gets into comparative analysis, like what did you say to them, and do you say that to me? The words and a lot of those things I think are sort of irrelevant. Now, how you set it up, how you did it, kind of what's going through your mind, those things that aren't comparison, those can be really important pieces of information in terms of understanding why. But the actual what happened, I think, often leads to too many intrusive thoughts. You're going to have plenty of intrusive thoughts to deal with. And So if he's in a course like that where he's listening to other people and having it kind of other people set an example for him, I find that it really helps people be able to ultimately do that disclosure simply because they can see what it really looks like. And they're watching other people real time, and it allows him to have hope that maybe he can tell you that and you won't rock kick him through the goalposts of life. Because there's an enormous amount of shame, and these are probably things that he swore he would take to his grave. Everybody does that. They're never going to tell. And, you know, what was astounding, as I watched it this weekend, I never ceased to be amazed, even after doing this for years, as the couples began to deal with the reality of what was, how quickly they were able to kind of come back to the same page, and how they were able to begin to work together, and just the amount of connection that they began to experience. And it was just simple honesty. And, you know, one of the guys was saying, you know, I want, you know, my wife to pat me on the back and tell me how, you know, amazing I am as a result of, you know, having told her everything. He said, but, you know, I kind of feel like honesty isn't like this over and beyond sort of thing. It's really kind of what I needed to be in first place, so I don't know why I expect her giving me kudos for doing what I should have been doing, but there's still a part of me that, you know, at least wants her to recognize that, you know, I really am trying. And hopefully the two of you can begin to see that you both have your side of the street of what you've got to deal with as you go through this process. And one of the other things that I think is important as you go through this is there is an enormous amount of processing and grieving. And it's, again, if you can do a course like Harboring Hope, or not Harboring Hope, but 911 Marriage, it allows him to understand how to walk you through that grieving process. So hopefully that helps with that a little bit. And man, once you ask him if he's willing to give you, if he's willing or ready for that disclosure, you might ask him, what's it going to take to get into the place where he would be ready to do the disclosure? That would be the other thing you might find useful for him that could help him out. So let's see here. Next question. Who's on first? I'm sorry, I love this. A dear friend spent 30 minutes telling me that sexual addiction is a hoax. It's not a physical drug addiction. It's just an excuse for those who can't be faithful and who only care about their own selfish needs for lust. It just gives them a reason to not take responsibility for their actions and lack of self-control and moral integrity. She says he will never change his behavior. I'll never know if he's cheating on me, and our five-month-old son will grow up to be just like his sinful, selfish father if I stay. She says her husband never loved me and never wanted to marry anyone. He only married me because he thought I was his salvation. Even if his issues are rooted in childhood trauma of abuse and neglect, it's not my problem to pay the price for his unfaithful and twisted behavior. She said he doesn't really want to stop and that he's manipulating me to believe that it's an addiction instead of the truth, which he selfishly wanted sex outside of our marriage and isn't capable of loving anyone. She says his remorse and promises are temporary because they are motivated out of guilt and fear of me leaving. She was a very supportive friend. I daily doubt myself on this on top. This on top was a huge blow according to the sexual addiction assessments. And an addiction therapist, my husband, said that had an addiction that began with compulsive masturbation, porn, and then cyber sex after his therapy. His behavior has put my support group over the edge. I'm afraid they are confirming my worst fears and doubts. And since he lied to me so much, I have to admit I have trouble trusting anything he says isn't just a tactic to get me to stay with him. Even if he seems genuine, when he said that he was in love with me, asked me to marry him, and said he vows and said his vows in July 2008. All while he was having an affair. He seemed genuine after the first time he cheated on me 4 years ago and promised never to talk or see that woman again, but it's been her all this time. So I can't trust him and his convictions. How do I know if he's safe to move toward with or not, even if he goes through all the therapy and programs available? I'm now more confused than ever. That's interesting. You know, as I was reading this, and then you're going to think this is crazy if you're on the line listening here, but my first response when I hear somebody that's this judgmental and takes this attitude is it immediately makes me think that she's holding a secret and she's actually been in an affair. I mean, she's talking about herself. She's not talking about him. You can never know another person. There's something that's happened in this person's life, whoever your friend is, because when someone responds like this, something's wrong with them. I don't know what it is.
She has had an affair.
Okay. Thank you. Well, that explains, because I mean, my first thought was she's talking about herself. Mm-hmm. And so that's not even about your husband. A lot of times when I see somebody being really judgmental, the first thing I begin to think is, okay, what are they saying about themselves? Because you don't get this sort of judgmentalism, tell somebody this, unless it has a tremendous amount of emotional charge within them. Mm-hmm. And that's about them. And it's not about your husband. So, honestly, I would pray for her. I mean, I don't know what's wrong. I mean, I'm hurt for her. I don't know what's going on. I do know. I'm sorry. What?
She's in a. I mean, her. She's a lot older than me. I'm 30, and she's like 50 years old. So, her relationship has no love in it. So, I think it was kind of transference is what you were saying.
Oh, I promise you. Because you can never know another person's motive. I mean, I always joke, you know, I say that catching a motive is a lot like trying to catch snipe at night on my ranch. I mean, I've had people go out snipe hunting and nobody's ever caught one. Catching a motive is even more difficult than catching a snipe. Because we can only judge another person by what it would mean if we were to do the same thing. I had a lady in my office a while back that was telling me that her husband, that her neighbor, next-door neighbor, was trying to seduce her husband. And I said, well, how do you know? And she was talking about this low-cut blouse and push-up bra and tight pants and all of this stuff. And I said, ma'am, I have no earthly idea whether or not your neighbor is trying to seduce your husband, but I do know if I ever see you dressed like that, what you're going to be about. And because that made her mad. But it's true. I mean, that, to her, if she acted like that, her intention, her motive would be to seduce somebody. That would be, in her mind, how you would do it. So, you know, I'd have to talk to the guy's neighbor, the lady's neighbor, before I could find out what her intention was, if she'd be honest. But When people kind of respond like that, I just hurt for them, and I don't know, I hope she finds healing, but I certainly don't think it says anything about your husband.
Okay.
But I do think it would be amazingly confusing if I were you and somebody told me that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just even sorry that happened to you. Hopefully you have other people that are speaking into your life that have worked with addictions. If you don't believe the material on sexual addiction, I mean, go look at, read some of, I don't know if you've read any of Daniel Amen's work on sexual addiction and look at the PET scans. I mean, it's so physiological, it's un-friggin' believable. I mean, you can literally look at the brain of somebody who's sexually addicted versus the brain of somebody who's not, and it's just, it looks like in the two prefrontal, in the prefrontal cortex, because of the activities, it looks like there are two eyes. Literally, there are black holes in the prefrontal cortex. I mean, it literally does brain damage. So, now, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? I don't know. And there's some, again, but if that person doesn't learn how to accept what the condition is and how to live with that condition, they can't ever be safe for their mate or in any relationship, for that matter.
He's accepted it.
Good.
It's me who struggles with it.
Well, like I said earlier, I would, the people that at least believe that and begin to live accordingly and understand that this is how they're going to live the rest of their life to keep people safe, they're the ones that have the best marriages.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I understand that I'm a human wrecking ball as an addict, that if I'm not, then I will naturally be self-centered. I will naturally go and do things I don't want to do. So I have to live my life so intentionally where I don't want to be a human wrecking ball. I want to protect my wife. You know, I want to protect my family. I want to protect the people I care about and I love. So I just know that I live a certain way. I follow certain procedures. I'm always involved in groups. But in the long run, what it's done, I think it's helped me to really consider other people and to learn things about love and giving and caring and nurturing and compassion. I would have never possessed those things if I hadn't been blessed with the gift of this addiction. So, you know, in fact, it was interesting. One of the mentor, not the mentor couple, but this past weekend, sometimes for people, we'll have a pastoral couple. And if people want to be able to talk about faith issues, they can. And this week at EMS, it was really interesting because it was an older couple, and he's a recovering alcoholic and a recovering sex addict. And it was amazing for those couples just to have somebody who's married 43 years now, well, this is 33 years in the past, and just kind of listening, saying, and just reinforcing the same thing. But he's one of the coolest guys I know. And I promise you, when he was acting out, he would have been one of the worst people you would have ever known. And what's made him the man he is today is the fact that he had this gift of this addiction that's kind of caused him to have to keep pressing forward and learning and growing and giving. And I mean, it's been a gift to him. It hasn't been a curse. Limerence and sexual addiction. Had a bunch of that this weekend, too. No, is limerence usually a part of sexual addiction, or does the sexual addict manipulate the object of supply so that they can keep them around? This is what my husband claims, that he said being romantic, he said romantic things to her because he wanted him to, she wanted him to leave me and marry her, and she accused him of just using her for sex and loving me. He said that he would say romantic things to her not because he felt they were true, but because they made him feel better. It silenced the anxiety, depression, and feelings of being unworthy. I swear the romantic words pissed me off more than cyber in the real sex with her. He used to talk to me that way when we first fell in love, and he says it is in no way the same, and when he never wanted to leave me. He just had to play the game with her to keep the supply around. What a jerk. You know, so the this weekend, I'm just thinking of that because I just came off the weekend. We had several sex addicts, and as we were talking, and we were talking without their wives present. And every one of them talked about this one piece about how, and I've heard this time and time again, so he is not unique. They will say whatever it is they feel like they need to say to be able to use the other person. To me, when someone is using, they're probably, they're so consumed and so self-centered, they have no thought, not only for their mates, but in, when I was active in my addiction, I use people. And if there's any one thing that I, maybe the, one of the things I feel most ashamed about in my own recovery, and these guys were talking about the same thing, is how they used other people and said whatever the other people wanted to hear just so that they could ultimately get what they wanted. And, you know, that is just frightening to me that, you know, we as human beings would do something like that. And that breaks my heart. So I suspect, yes, he said the exact same things to them that he said to you, because those are the words he knew how to use. But at the same time, the addict is doing it. It has different motives. The things I said to Stephanie were out of my heart for Stephanie. The things I said to other people were part of a pattern I developed in order to get people to do what I wanted. And that was, again, that was an interesting topic from the weekend, just because a lot of them were talking about their shame about doing that to other people. And so if he's an addict, then I would say most likely that's the case. That's also one of those pieces that, you know, I wish to goodness that nobody ever had to hear or read what someone said to another person, because the words, like in emails or texts or things like that, ultimately that's, when I talk about too much detail or where a comparative analysis sort of thing begins, this is a prime example. And because it leaves you with, you know, was it real when he talked to me? What did he say to her? It's the, for the hurt spouse, the thing that makes recovery the most difficult are those what I call comparison dilemmas that get created as a result of knowing things. And back to the not knowing another person's motive, you can only judge his motives by, again, what it would mean if you were to do the same thing. And that's tragic, because you would never use another person like that, so it's got to be real. I mean, that's the only way you can ferret it out. And because he also, or if the other is true, because you're all in or all out. You're black and you're white. And so if the other is true, if he didn't mean it when he said it to her, then he must not have meant it when he said it to you. The fact that he could be so double-minded that he would say one thing to one person and one thing to another, a lot of times is the part that's incomprehensible to the hurt spouse, because they would never be like that. They can't understand how someone could groom another person and use another person to their own end. And so I understand why you're having trouble getting your mind around that piece, and I'm so sorry that you ended up having to go through all that. Will a recovering sex addict ever be able to look at a woman without lustfully objectifying them? I thought a married man that was not like, I thought I'd married a man that was not like this, but obviously I'm wrong. Now that I know he's a sex addict, will he ever be able to change how he looks at women? Or will the feelings of lust filling him up never go away? He's not acted out since January, which is identifying his triggers and doing the 12 steps. He says he already feels freedom from bondage to lust. And he notices a trigger, if he notices a trigger, he redirects his mind instantly. It feels so degrading to find out I married a man who just looks at women as sex objects. So absolutely someone, but it's not just about learning, and this is one of the things, at least when I work with guys, that I really want to teach them. I mean, to me, it's not about learning or to avoid lusting or to avoid objectifying. It's also far more important that they learn ultimately to love, that they learn how to look at other people and what to look. It's almost like they don't know, you know, how to care for another human being, how to have concern. And so, I mean, a man's got to ultimately know his limitations. But so I don't know that you know, you that it's safe for all people, but it's still, to me, it's far more about, again, the learning book. Let me tell you a story that's kind of interesting, because I believe that, what is the proper way to look at another person? If you see something that's beautiful, how do you look at it and not covet it? How do you look at it and not lust for it? How do you look at it and not have a desire? I mean, you've got to find another way of understanding the whole concept. There's a story told, and I'm going to explain this one from a theological perspective. I don't know where you come from faith-wise, but it's always been one of my favorite stories of a man, I think, who understood things differently. One of the things that Jesus taught about in terms of how you look, which I think is more of a theological perspective than psychological, it's more of a moral perspective, he said, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. In other words, he's saying, you know, that what has been created was ultimately meant to reveal a concept that is much larger than us, that has much more value even than us, that there's a cause, there's a purpose, there's a life, it's beyond us and bigger than us, and in reality, we're not, life isn't about us, we're supposed to be about life. And so there was a bishop, back in AD in Alexandria, Egypt, named Nonus. And they were back working on the Nicene Creed. And his scribe wrote this story. And you can actually confirm it, go back and do some searching on Google. It's kind of an interesting story. But what happened is they were coming out of this church building. There was a stripper named Pelagia who was advertising a show she was going to be doing later that night. Well, three of the bishops, when they saw this woman, immediately averted their eyes. They kind of bowed their eyes because they didn't want, you know, they didn't want to lust. Nonus, on the other hand, just began to look at her. And he was going, oh, my word, have you ever seen anything so beautiful in your entire life? God, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Now, all Pelagia was wearing was some bracelets and necklaces, period. She was doing her Lady Godiva routine. And the other guys are saying, Nonus, look away, man. What are you doing? And as they looked back up at Nonus, there were just tears flowing down his face. And he was just weeping. He couldn't stop crying. And he just kept after that saying, such beauty sold to the lust of men. Well, Pelagia was so shaken by the way that Nonus ultimately looked at her that she literally came back to that building where she had seen him and confronted him. And she said, who are you? No man has ever looked at me like that. And he shared who he was and what he believed. And at that moment, she came to faith. And now she's known as Saint Pelagia. She was later martyred for her work in helping prostitutes come out of that lifestyle. Well, to me, the object is I want to be able, if I see somebody, not to lust for them, for me, but I want to be able to see the God intended in them and what makes them so incredible. I want to see hearts and souls, not TNA, so to speak. And I think for a sex addict that really begins to grow in love and understanding, it literally, it's not just a matter of not doing something. It's about learning how to care about people, to actually have a concern, but also to be aware of your own vulnerability and not, and I don't give guys permission when I talk about this stuff to go look at porn so they can see the God intended. That's not my point. But it is the point that I want them to learn to care about people and to see differently. And that is the ultimate vision. So in answer, it's a long question. Initially, the first stage is understanding if you're going to lust, if you can't not go there, you've got to learn be very careful about what you put in front of yourself, or at least to balance your eyes. But also learning to be concerned and to love and things like that and to see them differently is the ultimate goal. So, yes, they can change. They don't always have to live in that. Let's see. My husband told me about a time that his affair partner was at a music bar when we were together in Italy. It was right after we were married, and They had previously in the week gotten together, and he had masturbated in front of her and left. And this was a pattern in their relationship and for my husband's sexual addiction. He said that he saw us holding hands, and she was livid at him for being loving and affectionate with me, and told him later he was using her. Now, how long did it take her to figure that out? After moving to America for me and being with me for 3 years and then marrying me, she figured this out. Oh, you just asked the same question I just said. I asked if he was worried that she'd come up and say something to me. At that time, I was clueless about the affair and addiction. And he said she would not have had the guts. How could he have us in the same place and not freak out? Did this make the affair more exciting? Does he really want to stop? He seems remorseful beyond words, and since he started, and he started his 12-step work, 911, and therapy with an addiction specialist. If you met my husband, you would never think he was someone capable of this. He is gentle. Actually, I would probably be one of the few people in the world that would believe beyond a shadow of a doubt he's capable of this. So he's gentle, kind, and quiet. I never imagined he would be able to play it so cool. He always said after he had sex with her, it was the last time, but it never was. Why? Because he liked it so much? No. So let's start with the last part. Because it's an addiction. And you can say all day long, you're not going to do it again, but that's not your choice. You know, as I've said in some of the earlier calls, the alcoholic's point of choice is, you know, whether or not they pick up the first drink. One drink is too many, 20 isn't enough. So there's a powerlessness that comes along with an addiction. So I can say, I won't do it again. And all that probably assures is that ultimately I will do it again. Typically, when people say they won't do it again, what they're saying is, I'm normal, and I ought to be able to live like a normal person. And so they never really make any changes. They just have good intentions, which ultimately pave the road to hell. And so that is, you know, did he really want to stop? Yes. Was he capable of stopping? Absolutely not. And for that reason, you know, it would never work if what, you know, he's about – wanting to stop but not doing what's necessary. He didn't have the power to stop. This is probably the first time in his life that he's begun to really address the issue. Because if you don't accept what the issue is, then it'll never change. If you think about it, if I'm driving my car and I run out of gas, let's say, I can say, because the gas gauge is broken, how's that? I can say, you know, I never want to do that again. That was a horrible experience. I am not going to run out of gas again. But the bottom line is, if I don't get the gas gauge repaired, the probabilities of me running out of gas again are really pretty doggone high, right? It's going to happen at some point because I just won't be aware. And so a lot of times people will say they don't want to do that again. They don't fix the gas gauge, so to speak. So, yeah, I think he probably does want to do it. He just doesn't have the ability not to. Self-righteous. How does a married couple discuss the feelings and reasons for why a spouse could be unfaithful without being judgmental and self-righteous? At disclosure, I, the hurt spouse, understandably felt this way. But it's been 6 months now since disclosure, and my husband tells me I'm still treating him with that way despite the fact that I've already said I forgave him. What do I do? Gosh, you know, I wish I could actually hear one of your conversations. So there are two reasons. I mean, my first thought on this one is, has that other person because you may not be doing anything, but is he aware of the amount of time that it ultimately takes for someone to heal from, some sort of, I guess, I'm going to log back in here, in terms of going through the pain of things? Because I think that sometimes what happens is just because you may still be struggling with it and bringing it up, the fact that you bring it up, I mean, he could be almost controlling, manipulating you kind of by claiming that you're being self-righteous simply by saying that. Now, I don't know if it's the case. Maybe there's a place where when you bring it up, you bring it up in a way that's a very fast startup, and it's not, it's an emotional conversation, and it's kind of where almost parent to child. It was interesting. I had this weekend one of the couples when they were sharing, and in fact, this case I mentioned earlier, when she told him, his first response was to begin to lecture her about he had warned her about this, and she continued to do this, and he was being just pretty doggone judgmental and self-righteous. He hadn't done this, and so one of the things I did to kind of shift the conversation is I actually just gave him a list of feelings and told him he could only speak to her about feelings at this point, not be kind of giving his pros on how he saw everything. And because really what you're trying to do is get the other person to understand, but what really needs to be understood is the heart. And so if you're talking to him in terms of personal feelings and the impact on you, usually, and you keep talking about that, usually that, they don't see that as self-righteous. If they feel like you're lecturing, you might, are you talking down to them? Or is he trying to control you by trying to get you to shut off just as you begin to process still what's going on and the feelings involved and the pain with all of that? If he sees just your normal processing as you being self-righteous, then he needs to get a little better understanding of what the journey ultimately looks like. And so I would say he's missing something in the journey, so to speak. So that one's a little hard to answer. Hopefully that helps a little bit, though. Let's see. What's the difference between an affair and having a sexual addiction? My husband took the assessment. Oh, you did that one. The negative PowerPoint. What is it about porn that's so damaging? It turns out this was the beginning of my husband's sex addiction that led to cyber and a real affair with a cyber partner. I was ignorant of the dangers of porn. For it never appealed to me personally. What is it about porn that is so evil and leads to real sexual affairs? Okay, now, so let's say you've got somebody who drinks alcohol. Some people go to college, get in a fraternity or whatever, or a sorority, they drink, you know, and then they get out of college, they get a job, and that's just a phase of their life. So as I say, some people are cucumbers, and as they drink, and when they're finished drinking, they're still cucumbers. Some people, when they drink, they actually become pickles. There's a genetic presupposition that has to be in place for someone to drink and ultimately become an alcoholic. The same thing is very much true about a sex addict. I want to give a little caveat on the front end here. Not everyone that looks at porn is going to end up having a problem ultimately with porn, just like not everyone who drinks alcohol will ultimately have a problem with alcohol. Some will, probably not the majority by any means, but they will. For others, it's a huge piece. And for the sex addict, the building blocks of sexual addiction are always fantasy, pornography, and masturbation. That's just the building block. It starts from and then it expands from there. For the sex addict, because there's kind of this, as it's a drug seeking, there's an increased tolerance, and so there's a need for more and more. And so as the condition progresses and they have to have more and more, you know, that ultimately is what leads to riskier behaviors, to other behaviors, where it finally goes beyond the pornography. Now it's real people. Now it's this, it's that. It's just kind of that growing appetite of the monster, so to speak, that you've got to feed ultimately to kind of keep that feeling alive and coming towards you. I like that old saying, you know, at first you live to eat and then you eat to live. And it's the same thing with the addict. You know, at first you might have looked at porn just out of curiosity, but eventually, you know, or light up your life a little bit. Eventually your life is based on that, and that's what it centers around. And it's and once it becomes kind of a demon that controls your life, then, you know, it's like you begin to totally miss life. I mean, one, guys talk about this to me all the time. I experienced it. It's like you live in a bubble because what you're thinking about all the time is the next opportunity you get to do something. And so since you're focused on somewhere out here at 9 o'clock this evening, and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon or it's supper time with the family, you're not even really paying attention to what's going on at work or with the family because you're still focused on how do I get, you know, because you've got to get, you're just drug seeking. You're waiting to get to the next high at 9 o'clock. And all your mind's consumed with trying to figure out how to make that happen. And what is it about porn that's so evil? You know, I guess my thing about the problem with porn is I just think there's such an objectification of people, and that breaks my heart. It doesn't lead me to the place personally that I think I would want to go. And I think I don't learn to look at people rightly. It automatically, I think, teaches people and kids to objectify people rather than learning to see souls. It certainly can put a lot of things in the arousal template that create a great deal of difficulty within a marriage. One of the things about kind of, again, depending on how you look at marriage, I mean, to me, marriage is incredibly important, and those commitments are incredibly important in learning how to be one with another person. But for the sex addict, really, sex is about, I mean, I thought I'd figured sex out by the time I was 11 or 12 years old, you know, and I thought it was about orgasms, and the better the orgasm, you know, the better the sex. And so when I got married, I really thought that marriage was just going to be an extension of what my sexual addiction was, because I had no concept, because of my use of porn and things, of what love was really about, which was a soul connection, about being one with another person, where literally I didn't use my mate as a prop, which is where I started in the whole process. I mean, I just used Stephanie as a vessel of masturbation, but a place where I began to experience the universal oneness that really is about love and what I think we can become, a losing of myself in another person, a giving of myself, you know, allowing Stephanie to, you know, hold my heart like a fragile gem, or the essence of who I am as I hold her. I mean, it's a pretty astounding experience, and pornography doesn't teach you how to do that. Last but not least here, my husband told me about a time. Well, he did that one. So let me hit refresh here one more time. Okay, does anybody, we've got about 5 minutes, anybody have a question that's online that they would like to ask before I get off today?
I do, but since they're online, I'm going to wait and see if anybody else has another one.
Nobody's speaking up. Go for it.
Okay, so my question about the pornography. My husband's addiction with pornography started 10 years ago, and it pretty much stayed masturbation and pornography. And I wondered if you thought there was a connection to the fact that when he met me 3 years ago, and then we got married in 2008, and I got pregnant, which obviously was, you know, lots of different big changes, that then jumped it. And then it seems like it jumped the addiction up into, like, the affair category, which right. he had never been really in love with anybody, he told me before. But then, so it seems like the time where it would be just pornography would be when he was in love and married. Instead, it got really, really worse when he met
okay.
me and fell in love.
I get the question. So let me explain why that happens, okay? That's a great question. And actually, that is typically what happens. One of the strange things, and I'm just going to use myself as an example, but I thought when I got married that ultimately all of the stuff that had been a part of who I was in the past would just be funneled into the marriage. That I call it bad sex versus good sex, that kind of my things that were beyond a committed oneness relationship would be totally, I guess, be able to be fulfilled within that relationship. What I discovered is that you cannot substitute kind of what that extramarital sexual addictive behavior is for marriage, because marriage is about oneness, it's about relationship, it's about love, it's about heart, it's about commitment, it's about a lot of things that weren't involved with what I had before. So what happened was I actually made a commitment when I got married, not to do this stuff anymore. And it's almost like telling yourself you're not going to do it, making that the focus, ultimately empowered the entire process. I mean, the more I told myself I wasn't going to do it and tried not to do it, the more ultimately I wanted to do it, until it's like there was this pressure powder keg that eventually just kind of blew. And now, once I was in the relationship, because of almost what was happening with Stephanie, and not in a bad sense, but it's like there were a whole other kind of doorways that were slowly being opened up as I began to understand more about relationship. And so, you know, I think that there was kind of a strange counterfeit that began to morph over in the addictive side. It actually began after marriage. I mean, I just, I don't know. It was a very strange experience, but it was that thinking I could substitute one for the other, because the one thing I didn't want to do with Stephanie, and here was the problem, was to be intimate. And you're only as sick as your secrets, as they say. Or another thing that I heard, and Dan Allender has a great quote, and it's, the parts of the story that remain untold are the places where the devil ultimately has a stronghold. And so to deal with that stronghold, ultimately I was going to have to be able to be one with Stephanie. Well, to be one with Stephanie, I had to be willing to share everything. And to be honest with her, to be known by her, but I didn't really want to do that. So, well, I was afraid she'd leave me when she found out. So it's almost like getting married can actually make it pop a little bit, only because as you try not to do it, you almost increase the desire to do it, which can drag you then into even deeper things that you know, more things than you were doing prior to the marriage. So I think it's kind of complicated, but that's one of the reasons I think that it can get worse after marriage. Does that kind of answer that a little bit?
Yeah, that makes sense. Some of the other stuff I read is because the underlying root is that you're unworthy of being happy and you're unlovable, so it kicks that up, and then also increased anxiety and stress, which it was a huge increase in anxiety and stress because
yep.
you moved
to
another country, so that then, of course, feeds the addiction, too.
Yep, that would do it.
As cross-reference.
Well, okay. Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate everybody joining the call today, and I'll talk to you next Monday. Everybody have a good week. Bye-bye.
Thank you.